listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. As I think probably most of you here in the room will agree, we hear way too little about women serving in the American military. Helen Benedict, as writer Katha Pollitt points out, reports what others sweep under the rug and reveals a pattern where others see random events. She calls Benedict's wrenching expose, The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq, quote, must reading for anyone who cares about women, justice, fairness, the military, and the United States. Benedict structures her narrative around five women who fought in Iraq between 2003 and 2006. One of those soldiers memorably tells Benedict, there are only three things the guys let you be if you're a girl in the military, a bitch, a hoe, or a dyke. This is compassionate reporting that is neither left nor right. It is human. Helen Benedict is the author of 10 books. She's a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and she writes frequently on women, race, and justice. The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq, won the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. Her elegant, often wickedly funny novel, The Edge of Eden, about a British family's disintegration in the last gasp colonial outposts of the Seychelles Islands in 1960s, was just released from the Soho Press. In conversation with Helen tonight, we're very fortunate to have Deanne Stillman, who is the author of several books, including Mustang, The Saga of the Wild Horse in the American West, which she came and spoke about last season, a fabulous book, and 29 Palms, a true story of murder, Marines, and the Mojave, and Joshua Tree, Desolation Tango. A critically acclaimed work of literary nonfiction, 29 Palms was first published in 2001 and named a Best Book of the Year by the LA Times. Hunter Thompson called it a strange and brilliant story by an important American writer. And it was recently reissued in a new updated edition by Angel City Press with a foreword by T. Jefferson Parker and a preface by Charles Bowden, who actually spoke here last week. So you see, it all comes together. I do look forward to your comments and questions about our topic tonight. It gives me great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming Helen Benedict and Deanne Stillman to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming.
Yes, and thank you, everybody, for coming. I echo that as well. And big thanks to Louise for that wonderful introduction. And should I start over with the thank yous? It's chilly. We were talking about how we can warm each other up with body heat and maybe more talking. Anyway, I agree with everything that Louise was saying about Helen's book, and I, in fact, reviewed it in the LA Times, and which reminds me, another thank you to you, Helen, for writing this very important book and telling us about this. Telling about this little-known war, the war inside the U.S. military against our female soldiers and Marines, and thanks to you who are in the audience, you who serve, we really appreciate it. First, I wanted to ask you to just kind of give us an overview of your fine work. You profile five women in your book, and you talk about how they're each had different reasons for wanting to join the military, but of course, each encountered a surprise in a very disturbing way, and each was affected in profound ways that we're still hearing about today. And can you tell us a little bit about one of your characters, Jennifer Spranger?
Yes,
did I say
Jennifer
it right?
Spranger,
who's written so eloquently.
Thanks. I want to start off just to give it a little context that I interviewed more than 40 women who served in the Iraq War, including as well as quite a few who served elsewhere. And I interviewed people, women from all, and men as well, served in Afghanistan, Korea, Bosnia, First Gulf War, Vietnam. But out of the 40 veterans of the Iraq War, that I chose the five. So I don't want it to sound as if I only interviewed five. But that's important. And I chose the five to reflect different experiences, different ranks, different ages, different coming from different areas and socioeconomic backgrounds, and so on. Jennifer grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, which is a little town an hour north of Chicago. It's one of those factory towns that used to be thriving until all the factories in America just about closed down in the early 90s. And downtown became deserted and jobs were gone and really and crime came in. And it was one of those dead-end towns that all young people wanted to get out of. And one of the prime ways to get out was to join the military. Jennifer's father is a firefighter, her mother a nurse, and her father had always been an admirer of the military and always regretted that he'd been too young to fight in Vietnam. So she had been quite fascinated by the army, in particular since she was 12. So when she turned 17, she enlisted. Her father had to sign a waiver to give her permission because of her age. And this was before 9/11. She joined the military police reserves, went to school. Then 9/11 happened. The war started in Afghanistan. The war started in Iraq. And I thought I'd read you just a little tiny snippet from the book, which is when Jen is deployed to Kuwait. And it starts when she steps off the plane. The stench was overpowering, strong enough to make Jen recoil as she stepped out of the military plane into the Kuwait night. She had no idea what it was. Rotting garbage, burning oil fields, dead bodies. She only knew it smelled nothing like Racine, Wisconsin. The air was so thick that the inside of your nose, your ears, was completely black, she said. It was absolutely disgusting. Cramped and exhausted from 18 hours of flying, she and the other fresh soldiers filed down the airplane stairs and into a waiting bus. It was February 2003, the month leading up to the invasion, and they were to be driven to Camp Arifjan, a huge U.S. military base south of Kuwait City, to wait for the war. On the way, she huddled her small frame into her seat, her blonde hair tucked under her army beret, wishing she could at least glimpse whatever there might be to see in the night outside. But the soldiers were forbidden to open the curtains or even peek out. She felt as if she were being delivered to war blindfolded. When she reached the camp and climbed off the bus, she found herself in a vast complex of warehouses and tents, surrounded by coils of razor wire. She and the other new arrivals were ordered into a long metal warehouse the size of an airplane hangar, stuffed with thousands of green army cots, almost everyone occupied by a man. Jen was to sleep an arm's length away from her neighbor on either side, face to foot, to minimize the spreading of disease. If she needed a bathroom, she would have to weave her way across the room with all those men watching her. She lay down and changed her clothes inside her sleeping bag, feeling a long way from home. The building reeked of sweat and feet and the musty tang of masculine bodies. Jen was one of only four women in a platoon of 34 men and one of 20 women in a company of 213. She was to live and work in close quarters with those men for the next 7 months. Camp Arifjan is known as one of the most dangerous bases for women soldiers in the Middle East. Built by the Kuwaiti government for American troops, it held about 10,000 service members and private contractors when Jen was there, almost all of them male. They call Camp Arifjan Generator City because it's so loud with generators that if a woman screamed, she can't be heard, another soldier told me. They were saying the number of rapes that were happening on base by soldiers were very high, and they told us not to travel anywhere without another soldier. It soon became routine for platoon leaders to order their women soldiers never to go outside at night without a female companion, not just at Arifjan, but at all bases. Many resented this, including Staff Sergeant Liz O'Haron of the Air Force, who was in Iraq in 2006. They tell us, after we hit the deck from an incoming mortar shell, that we shouldn't walk alone at night on base, she said. We, as in females. How am I supposed to track down another female to go eat when I want to, shower when I want to? Females aren't exactly crawling around this joint. Screw you. You deploy me here and tell me it's not safe for me to walk alone to get a bite to eat because I'll probably get raped by one of my own.
Yeah, it's a really powerful passage. Can you kind of backtrack a bit now and give us the broad overview? Give us those harrowing statistics that you have about what's going on with women in general in the military.
Well, when I began this book, I had no idea what I would find out. I knew about the tailhook scandal and some of those earlier ones in the 90s in the academies. But I began to hear very soon from the women soldiers I was interviewing and Marines and Air Force and Navy, these stories of sexual harassment and abuse and rape. And I began to hear them with alarming frequency. So I dug into I looked at the statistics given to us by the Defense Department, and then I looked into the statistics gathered by the VA from veterans. And there's a really important difference because the DOD, the Defense Department, only collects numbers of rapes that are reported by active duty soldiers, that are reported to officials. And by their own admission, that's only about 10% of the total of sexual assaults. Whereas veterans just feel much freer to tell what really happened. So I came across a study that found 30% of women had been raped while serving. That's almost one in three. And another study that found 74% sexual assault while serving and 90% sexual harassment. Now, all these statistics are a little iffy because they vary, but over and over again, they are horrifyingly high. And that was reflected in my interviews. I'm just hearing those stories all the time.
I think when you factor in the military code of sucking it up, you know, and in general, people in the military aren't supposed to complain about anything. And most don't, and the problem is compounded here. So consider when you factor that in, I mean, it's still an incredibly high number of assaults. And
It's hard enough in civilian life to report a sexual assault because the culture still tells women to blame themselves, that they somehow asked for it or that they were careless, that it was their fault. Plus, there's the fear of repercussions, of revenge, being dragged through the courts, being blamed, being humiliated, and so on. But in the military, it's all that plus some. You're seen, if you could make any complaint about a fellow soldier, you're seen as a snitch, really, and a traitor, because the bonds are so close. Your women are often accused of being failures as soldiers because they should have been able to defend themselves. They must be weak, no good as soldiers. They're told to blame themselves too, because they must have asked for it, they must have flirted, they must have drunk too much, they must have walked in the wrong place. It goes on, and it's enough to discourage 90% from ever saying anything until afterwards.
Right, and then when you think about things like Agent Orange syndrome, which of course came out of the Vietnam War, and Gulf War syndrome now with the Gulf War, and all the other ailments that are coming out of the latest wars, and people are not encouraged to report that either. And I think it took when the Gulf War was in the early, you know, like 1990, 91, it took the government at least 10 years to even acknowledge that maybe there was such a thing as Gulf War syndrome. So it's we're talking about big secretive institutions that move slowly. And don't want to step up and
are very protective of their reputations,
right,
and their own. I mean, there are commanders out there, thank goodness, and sergeants and everybody in between, chain of command, who do care about this and do care about justice, and have chosen that to keep the reputation of their platoons or their units looking good by following justice and doing the right thing. But there are others who think that the best way to protect their career and the reputations of their platoons or whichever unit they're in charge of is to cover up everything and intimidate those who wish to report wrongdoing out of reporting by countercharges and threats. And sometimes some of those people are the ones who are doing the wrong themselves, unfortunately. I mean, the average age of an assailant in the military is about 28, and the average age of the victim is 21, and most of the assailants are of higher rank. So there's also the abusing your power aspect of this in the military, which is particularly egregious because the chain of command structure gives you so much power. And you know, you're not supposed to violate it.
Right. No fraternizing between the ranks, in fact,
right.
as they call it.
Right.
You know, in reading your book, something, many things occurred to me, but one of the things that really stood out is that you're really talking about a female warrior tradition, and we kind of don't think of it, that we think that this is like a new thing, women, you know, in combat, which in a way it is, but in some ways not really, because... we do have a warrior tradition in this country that goes back for hundreds of years, and by that I'm referring to Native American warriors who did include women in critical roles during the frontier wars. And one in particular I always found quite fascinating, a woman named Lozen, who was a Chiricahua Apache, and she fought with Geronimo, and she was considered... you know, one of their fiercest warriors. And in fact, her brother was the famous chief Victorio, who said, Lozen is my right hand, strong as a man, braver than most, and cunning in strategy. Lozen is a shield to her people. And I just always thought that was just such an amazing tribute. And here we have in your book, in this warrior tradition, a woman named Ellie Painted Crow, who herself is part Apache. And I thought it was really interesting when I read about her that she told you in your interviews, you know, about her long line of you know, warrior ancestors and so on.
Yeah. That reminds me, I'll read a little bit of what she said about that too, but when you look at guerrilla wars and civil wars around the world and throughout history, it was very common for women to be combatants. It's only in formal armies that it's less common, which is an interesting difference. But also, women in ground combat, we've never seen that to the extent that we've seen it in the American armies that we see it in Iraq. More women have served in Iraq and fought and died and been wounded in Iraq than all American wars put together since World War II. So it represents a huge historical change, even as at the same time the Pentagon still bans women from ground combat. So that, you know, women are officially doing something that's not supposed to exist. One of the veterans in my book is here, Micaela Montoya, who started the whole book. She was the one who told me about the Bitch Ho Dyke thing, and she inspired me to begin. And she was a gunner. She was doing a job that it says in the handbook you're not allowed to do if you're a woman, and it just shows. And I met many women who were gunners in Iraq. I met women who were kicking through the doors and raiding Iraqi houses alongside the infantry under the rubric of combat support, which sends women into war just like men. But back to Ellie Painted Crow, because there's an important quote here speaking of the history of Native Americans and women warriors. Joining the military, she told me, is something that Native people find great honor and pride in, and it's very hard to find things that bring honor to your family for Natives nowadays. The military is our way of holding on to the idea of being a warrior, of being a provider and a protector. And indeed, on a per capita basis, more Native Americans serve than any other population, overrepresented by 300%. They make up 0.75% of the population at large, but 2.6% of the military. And in some tribes, nearly 70% of the men are soldiers. So how much we give back to them for all this service is a whole other subject.
You know, when I was working on my book, 29 Palms, I went to... While I was out in 29 Palms, I met some Native Americans who were in the service, and they were all wearing this fantastic T-shirt that says, maybe some of you have, maybe you've seen it yourself, Ellen. It says, the original Homeland Security. And it's got Sitting Bull, Geronimo, Black Elk, and, you know, some of you have seen it, right? And it's just a fantastic T-shirt, and it just, this is exactly what we're talking about. I mean, the reason there are so many Native Americans in the armed services, and I talked with some of them about it,
yeah,
as well, is that they this is their homeland, and they do feel that they're bound to protect it in spite of, you know, what went on here during the frontier era.
Also in spite of often coming across a great deal of racism in the military.
Yeah.
Ellie Painted Crow, she's the woman on the cover of the book, by the way. She told me that when she was in Iraq, a commander was giving them a pep talk, and he ended it by saying, "It's Indian territory out there, go get 'em." And she stopped and she said, "If it's Indian territory out there, then maybe I'm on the wrong side."
Well, you know, the term the hostiles, and we hear it every week on 24, which I happen to love, that comes right out of the frontier wars.
Yeah, yeah.
And one more point about Native American women in the armed services, and you mentioned her in the beginning of your book, Lori Pistawa. This was the first woman killed in combat in the Iraq War, and she was a Hopi Indian. And she also had joined up on account of this warrior tradition. And she was she died in the infamous Jessica Lynch incident. Remember that? And Jessica
Same
Lynch...
Same ambush she was... You know, they were driving together.
Right.
And Jessica actually says she saved her life.
Right.
But she never got any press.
Right. But Jessica has come forward many times and said that Lori was a real hero of that ambush, and it doesn't get much coverage.
Yeah.
I wanted to get back to the bitches, hoes, and dykes quote, because... sounds like a line out of a rap song, but it really goes to the heart of this problem in a way. It has to do with demonizing the other, and once you start calling people names, you can do anything you want. And you know, this comes up. You heard this over and over and over again in your book, and you quote those dirty marching cadences that I also heard when I was out in 29 Palms, and the worst one I heard was like, "I wish all the women were bells in the tower. If I were a clock, I'd bang them on the hour." Mm-hmm. And you singing left, 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 right. I mean, you had
I quoted one in this book. I can't even say in polite company, but it wasn't just dirty. It was really, really violent towards women. I mean, it's horrifying. It involves chainsaws. Mm. I won't go further than that, but it's in the book. Well, yes, I mean, it's really deeply rooted. The attitude towards women as sexual prey and as second-class soldiers, and even kind of as the enemy, is really deeply rooted in the military. It goes way back to our very first armies ever in history. When you think about the pillaging and raping, you know, that you read about in the Bible and so on, I mean, women were supposed to be booty, not fellow warriors. And I think, for example, drill sergeants have been using ugly language about women to bring down the dignity of their recruits. You know, when they're trying to break down the civilian in a recruit and build up a warrior instead, you insult the recruit a lot, as I'm sure you all know. You're constantly antagonizing him or her, and one of the main ways you insult him is by calling him a lady or other words that are more vulgar for girls. So even just the word like lady or girl, which isn't inherently insulting, is used in an insulting way. But they'll also whip up the anger of recruits by saying, you know, your wife's just, you know, a sloth and she's sleeping with everyone, she's cheating on you, and what are you, a cuckold, and so on. And that's just so deeply rooted that people don't even notice it. I mean, I've had so many women soldiers say that they heard, and I'm sorry I keep using the word soldiers because I really do mean to include all the branches, but they heard so much foul language and derogatory language about women all the time that they stopped even noticing it. It's just the norm. But of course, it sends a message all the time. You are second class. You are not wanted. You are sexual prey. You are looked down on. You are the other. You are the weak one. You are the outcast. You are the enemy. To a certain extent. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more specifically about Ellie or Jennifer, perhaps, either in terms of exactly what happened to them and what they went through when they tried to report and go up the chain of command?
I will talk about, Jen was assaulted by when she was still training, she was assaulted by her sergeant, and harassed by him. But when she said she was going to try and move, she didn't dare report him, but at least try and get permission to move to a different unit. She was he threatened to commit suicide, and that got him carted away. So she kind of was saved from that situation in a different way. But then when she was in the middle of a mortar attack, one of the soldiers with her in the tent climbed on top of her and tried to rape her in the middle of a mortar attack. And then another of the soldiers in my book, she was a combat correspondent with the Air Force, and she was sent to Afghanistan to cover the 10th Mountain Army Division, which is all male. And because of the shortage of troops, she was given night guard duty one night. And she was standing there alone at night, dying for a cigarette. So she put down her weapon and walked 20 feet away to the smoke deck where she was allowed to smoke. And she was put in a chokehold and dragged away by a man. All she could see was that he had an American Army uniform on. And he raped her. And afterwards, she said, I remembered what I'd seen in Law and Order. So I went back to the deck. I got my weapon. I finished out my guard duty, and then I didn't take a shower. I did all the right things. And she went to the command to report it, and they said, "Fine, we will investigate this for you, but at the same time, we're going to charge you with dereliction of duty for abandoning your weapon in a combat zone, which will get you court-martialed and ruin your career, end your career. Do you still wish to press charges, Sergeant Ribeiro?" And she said no, and she shut up. And yes, she should never have put her weapon down in a combat zone. That is a very serious offense, but that doesn't mean you deserve to be raped. So she blamed herself for 6 months. She couldn't even tell her mother what was wrong. She left the Air Force, and she had it was third generation. Her whole life it had been her dream to be an officer in the Air Force, and it ruined the dream. As for Ellie Painted Crow, in her 22-year career in the military, she was raped several times, but she never reported it because she knew it would only get her into trouble.
Yeah, I think it's really important, as you point out, to understand that for a lot of people who join the military, it is their dream. I mean, yes, people go in for all sorts of reasons that they need the job. It's either that or jail in some cases, or they're fleeing, you know, in the case of some of your characters, of violence in the household. But for some, it really is a dream. You know, they want to serve their country. And these are female patriots here.
Well, that's one of the things that broke my heart the most about these interviews, is that I was very moved by the idealism of a lot of the young soldiers I talked to. Yes, maybe I didn't agree with it. Yes, maybe I thought it wasn't well informed enough, but they were young and they hadn't been taught much of anything about Middle East and in the Middle East politics in school. And they had noble dreams about wanting to give back to their country. They believed a lot of the rhetoric about how we were going to liberate Iraqis and give them a better life. They thought they were going to do good. And it really killed me to see such idealistic young women having their dreams and hopes and ideals stamped on, not only by what they actually saw in Iraq and what began to come out about that war, but by the mistreatment from their fellow soldiers who they thought would treat them like brothers, you know, who they thought would be upstanding and who they could count on in battle. The reason I call the book The Lonely Soldier is because I was really saddened, and heartbroken is a better word, to find out how alone so many of the women feel out there. I mean, what is the one comfort that soldiers have always had in war? It's camaraderie. It's the band of brothers. It's that loyalty, that closeness we've been hearing about out of war after war. But too many women are denied that feeling, sometimes because they're literally alone serving with many, many men, but sometimes because of this atmosphere I described of them being treated as outsiders and, you know, really not getting the camaraderie. And I would ask them, well, you know, if you're being surrounded by men who are harassing you all the time, how do you feel when you're in battle? How do you feel when you're in danger and they're supposed to be watching your back? And they said, I feel alone.
Yeah, it's a really profound title, and, you know, quite moving. Let's talk a little bit about the pressure cooker that the military is, because I know that you get into the recruiter situation, and in particular, one of your characters, Michaela, who's here, what happened to her with the recruiter in Rosamond, and it's happened to many other people as well. I know that recruiters are under a lot of pressure, and they'll say almost anything, apparently, to bring people in.
Yeah, and Rosemead. Well, it's a
Rosemead.
Michaela told me, and it feels funny to be telling your story for you. You should come up here, but even though I guess that's what I did in the book, but you're here. She went to a high school, the local high school in the Mexican area, and recruiters were in the hallway all the time, and as they have been throughout this war, you know, targeting immigrant areas, poorer areas, working class areas, targeting areas where they know they can get kids who don't quite know where they can go next or what kind of job they can get. Also offering citizenship to immigrants. And Michaela told me they were such a presence in her high school, she doesn't even remember the representatives from other careers. And they promised, she said they came in, there was this one guy, he would come blasting hip-hop outside of his window and looking really cool, and he took her friend to lunch, and he started to have an affair with one of her friends, even though her friend was only 17. He was married in his 30s, I think. And this, I dug into the background, and I found that there were all these reports of recruiter abuse, of sexual exploitation of recruits. But also, and in a way this is the most important point at all, if you read the enlistment contract that everybody signs when they join the military, there is a line in there that says that none of the promises that recruiters made you have to be upheld.
Wow.
It's right there in black and white. So they can say whatever they want. Now, there are standards, and some of them do get into trouble when they lie, but some of them don't. And in my book, I cite several cases of recruiters who were caught telling students that the war was over, that they'd never have to go overseas, and all kinds of stuff to get them.
Yeah. You know, I have to say that this is a tradition that goes back for decades, probably to day one in the military. I think recruiters have been under pressure forever. Not that this makes any of it right, but I know that during the Indian Wars, recruiters would go to the docks in New York and tell immigrant, you know, spin out some wonderful tale. Hey, come out west where you know, the oranges are growing on trees and you'll find gold. And these were people who didn't speak any English, you know, Italians and German immigrants and so on, young boys, and they would go out west and, you know, did not make it back, and they were pressed into service you know, very high numbers, and they ended up, you know, killed in very brutal ways and so on. And the military needs people, and they will. And this, unfortunately, this is all collateral damage. Recruiters, as you know, there's a high number of suicides among recruiters these days. I mean, I think that's a real consequence.
Well, the pressure is terrible. And it especially went up when the Iraq War began, after 9/11, because, as is not commonly known, enlistment dropped enormously after 9/11. Young Americans did not rush to recruitment. It went down in every demographic group, but it went down most dramatically among African Americans, 58%. And nobody's done a really comprehensive study of why, but I've seen some sort of off the cuff, groups of interviews, and a lot of people said, a lot of African Americans said, A, I already live in a war at home, and B, why should I go kill other brown people for this country? I don't believe in this war. And and in a way, African Americans were way ahead of everybody else in seeing some of the things that were wrong, and before we knew about the WMDs not really being there and so on. But yeah, every group dropped. So having wars.
Are you including the Marines in that? Because I think
Army.
The Marines are okay. I think Army. The Marines are the only branch of the military to this day to consistently meet their recruiting goals.
It varied from branch to branch, but the Army, it went way down.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I think with Marines, the thing is they're recruiting an attitude. It's not really a gig. I mean, it's a whole different thing that goes on there. Very interesting and apart from the statistic you cite about the number of people number of women or I think it's men and women in general, isn't it, who've experienced abuse, sexual abuse as children is pretty staggering.
Two studies, one done in 2006 of Marines and one done earlier of the Army. I think it was that way around. One done in the 90s. And they found that 50% of the men joining had been physically abused as children, and 50% of the women joining had been sexually abused, and several as children or in their pasts, and many had been both. And so we have an enormous number of people joining the military to escape violent, horrible homes. And this can be a problem when among the people who are into counter-recruiting and going to high schools and trying to persuade kids not to join. I think it's very important to inform young people of what they're really getting into, so they understand. Although you could never talk somebody out of it if they really want to go in, I think. But if you're not also offering jobs or facing the reality that whatever you tell them about war and the military, it doesn't sound as horrible to them as what's happening at home. You know, you've got a gap between what you're trying to do and what will actually happen.
Yeah, in some cases it is not to minimize, the horrors of war, but in some cases the military does become a family that they never had, a caring family. It's a community. They do have a band of brothers and sisters, and it does, fulfill a number of things that have been lacking.
Well,
that tends to be more true for the
men. It happens to some women, and it's... There are not everybody. I said one in three are raped. That means two aren't. And some are lucky enough to serve with other women who they like. Just because you serve with another woman doesn't mean you get on with her. But and there's also a lot of competition between women in the military, which can be very the opposite of supportive. So that finding the family in the military is much more of a male experience than a female, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, this abuse statistic is quite staggering in that, it suggests, of course, a situation in which people play out these things in different ways down the line with different people. So it puts everybody at risk for a number of reasons.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's quite well known in the field of psychology that abused boys often, not always, but often grow up into abusive men. So you've got, especially those who've been sexually abused, or, you know, violent families create violent men. And so you've got, you know, if you've got so many coming in, plus, of course, the military is an inherently violent institution, you've got quite a difficult brew there. I just have to say, though, that I'm talking about the people who are having a hard time, not everybody. Mm-hmm. And I've had many male veterans come and see my play on this same subject and read my book or come to my lectures who are just as concerned about this and outraged as I am. And I want to acknowledge them because I don't want to make it sound as if I'm making all, you know, all the men in the military sound like monsters, because I deeply don't believe that. But there are way too many exploiting and abusing women for it to be acceptable.
Yeah, no, I found the same thing while I was working on 29 Palms. There were Marines who were critical in helping me tell my story and opened many doors for me, and they were horrified about exactly what you're talking about. Just really ashamed of, you know, that it was going on in, you know, among their band of brothers. Yeah. So I agree with you. Something that you do in the end of your book, which I think is really important, you talk about solutions. So what can you you know, we have a few minutes left. Can you, what, you've laid out a, you know, very serious problem which can't be solved overnight. You know, we're talking a year, you know, years of, you know, turnaround here. Where do we start?
Well, it's really, I had to write a whole chapter to answer that question, and even then I only scratched the surface, because as I said, you know, a lot of it is in the culture, and the culture goes very deep. Some people say, well, it'll help when some of the older command, who are most resentful of men, of women being in the military and most hostile to them, age out, and that younger guys are more willing to accept women as equals, more used to seeing women as equals, and will help. But that ignores the amount of misogyny that's still so deeply rooted in the military. So I think the language in drill instruction has to be changed. I think women have to be given full status as soldiers. I mean, I don't like either of the wars we're in now at all. But I think if a woman wants to be a combat soldier, it is paternalistic and really and old-fashioned and way out of time to say you can't. So, and as long as the Pentagon bans women from combat, they will always be seen as second-class soldiers, and we will always have a problem. And I know that's a controversial point of view, but it's what most women soldiers I know want. Not that I'm saying they all want to be combat soldiers, nor do men, for that matter, but the ones who are ready for it should be allowed to do it, and should be given all the recognition for it. But we need to revamp so many things, it's hard to know where to begin now. Certainly the language. There need to be trained counselors, not just in combat stress, which already exist out, you know, in theater, as we interestingly call war, but also trained in childhood sexual abuse counseling and in sexual assault counseling. We need counselors. We need doctors for women out there. We need. Ellie Painted Crow had to go to Kuwait to get, you know, gynecological treatment that she should have been able to get on base, because there was no doctor who knew anything about female anatomy. We need a VA system that recognizes that women are in combat, and that they are getting traumatic brain injuries and PTSD from combat, just like men. We need to. The military is doing a lot of revamping in its training at the moment of sexual prevention of sexual assault. Well, they've made new videos and new campaigns, and I've still not yet met a soldier who takes that seriously. I mean, you know, it's like those college courses, don't date rape. I mean, it's
anchor
basically
management.
It sounds, a lot of it sounds silly to people. Yeah. You've got to have commanders from, you've got to have people from the bottom to the top and the top to the bottom who really respect women and will not tolerate this kind of treatment and want to see women as their sisters in combat, sisters in arms, sisters, you know, in distress often, because war is distressful, who deserve all the respect and honor that that the men would like to give each other. So those are just a few of the things. I also think that it's time that we recognized how large a role remorse plays in post-traumatic stress disorder, especially out of Iraq. PTSD is much worse at the moment for Iraqi veterans than Afghanistan, although that might change. And it's not only because people in Iraq up till lately have seen much more horror and had many more brushes with death and more have died, more have lost limbs and so on. But it's also because more people have trouble understanding what we're doing in Iraq than in Afghanistan and have from the beginning. And a lot of the soldiers, and so many more than I ever would have expected, men and women soldiers I talked to came back from Iraq after what they saw, the children being killed and so many civilians being killed and burned, and saying, what are we doing there? Why are we here? Why did I let myself be used to do that? And just to go back to Jen, I'd like to read a last passage that she said to me near the end of our interviewing, after she'd been back for a while. At the beginning, I wanted to believe that Saddam was the reason we were there, but that was the biggest lie. The civilians didn't want us there. I can't tell you how many Iraqi children were standing by the side of the road pretending to shoot us. Seems to me we're just breeding a new generation that hates us even more. I can't think of the war as anything but a waste now, a waste of money and human lives. It's really, really disgusting. In the end, I didn't believe anything I was told. I saw how we weren't helping their lives at all. We were making it worse. She paused, raising her plastic cup to her lips for a sip of water, then shakily putting it back down. I was nothing but proud when I first went into the military. I can't tell you how proud it made me to put on that uniform. I still have it. She gestured upstairs to her bedroom. But I won't even look at it. I thought we were so noble. Now I'm ashamed. I didn't hear that from everyone, but I heard it from a lot. And I happen to think it takes an enormous amount of courage to look in the mirror and say to yourself, I think I allowed myself to be used for something that I now believe was really wrong. And to say that out loud and to face it and then to have to live with it, it takes a huge amount of courage, and I admire people who can do that.
I think you're right, and that's the lonely soldier right there.
Yeah, that's a very lonely feeling. Yeah.
Is there anything else you feel people should know before we open it up to questions? Are we ready?
Let's open it
should we
up
do
to
it
questions.
Now?
Okay. I'd yeah. rather answer,
okay.
yeah.
Sure. Do you have a mic? Yeah. Are you raising your hand for a question, or are you?
No, she has the mic.
Oh yeah. Do you want right there in the back row?
Of the 10% of assaults that are reported, how many are prosecuted? How many are incarcerated? Can you talk about any specific cases where there's a good model to look at?
The percentages vary from year to year, but they're really minute. I think it's something, the last report, and I don't have all the numbers exactly in my head anymore, but around 8% were followed up, were prosecuted, and a very small slice of that actually got punishments that were as serious as being put in prison. Most of the punishments were demotion in rank and being moved to a worse job or a different platoon. So the Defense Department itself admits that this isn't very good. It's much worse than the rate of prosecution and conviction for sexual assault in civilian life, which is already pretty bad. But there are some who do get convicted, yes. There's something else as an interesting statistic I came across, which is that out of all the veterans in jail, in civilian life now, in civilian jails, veterans, 1 in 4 are in there for sexual assaults. So it's happening afterwards and outside, and that's where the prosecutions seem to be happening more at the moment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I called on right her.
Down here in the second row.
I'm wondering if you have any information about how the American military with women compares to other countries, the Israelis or the any other countries with women in the military.
Yeah. Well, Israel is the most different because there it's 50-50 men and women, and it's a draft and everybody has to serve. Although women are also banned from ground combat in Israel, not from air combat, same as here, not from the sea, but... and there is sexual harassment and assault, but it seems to be more on the level that you get in civilian life, and it seems to be more like in the office situation where, again, it's abuse of people in power, superiors abusing inferiors. And when one of these cases comes to light, there's a lot of press, but it's still a problem as it is in civilian life. And it's a problem enough for there to be concern. In other countries that I've looked at, Canada, Britain, Italy, and France, it's more like here. But the fact of the matter is that there's very little studies in those other countries of this subject. It hasn't really been done yet. It's new here, and it hasn't been done there. But I've come across one or two newspaper reports about sexual assault and... and the problems with women, the way women soldiers are treated, yeah.
Oh, yes. I can't really see.
A question and a comment. The question is regarding the ranks of the officers. What percentage are females, and are they in the same boat as the regular soldiers? And a comment is, if there's anything that is known as historical deja vu, I think we're living it right now. Last night, American Experience televised the My Lai massacre. Mm-hmm. And I know that this room is full of conscientious and reasonable people. How come we're not on the streets like they were in 1968 and 69? What's happening to us?
Yes, I've been wondering that from the beginning. The usual answer to the last one is because we don't have a draft. If we had a draft, people would be on the streets again. I'm not sure that's the reason to bring the draft back, though. But it's problematic. We are having, yes, there's a lot to trouble our consciences. Now I've lost your first question. What was it? Do you remember?
Did you say you were discussing the My
Lai? Oh, officers.
Okay,
officers.
Sorry.
There are a lot. The statistics of women officers, I mean, remembering that women make up 17% of the military and only 10% in Iraq, 1 in 10 women, their troops is a woman. In the army, anyway, they're proportionally more officers until you get to the top. Women do leave the military in greater numbers than men. They are pressured out. They are, because of these conditions I've been described, a lot of them can't take it. But there are some at the top. There are very few generals, but there are officers. And officers do have histories of the same kind of histories. The amount of abuse of women that goes on in the academies is enough to make your hair fall out. The Air Force Academy is a nightmare for women, an absolute nightmare. That's another book.
Down here in the front row.
I find it's a very fascinating topic, and I think it's sort of really something that we all need to discuss, not only in the services, but in daily life. And when we're looking and really not taking any notice of what's going on politically with all the crimes and sexual harassment that people go through and Tiger Woods syndrome. I think it goes back to what we have to do as parents is educate our children and really educate them to be decent human beings and to, as you said, you meet lots of men in the service who are wonderful and unfortunately they get tainted by people who behave badly and get away with it. And now I'd like to ask you from your book, has there been any repercussions as far as people taking notice of it and asking you for help? And
yes, there's been quite a lot, which is, I guess, why one writes such a book. A lot of the women soldiers on that level have told me that they had no idea how common their experiences were, and they'd felt completely alone. And I think that's really helped them, and to just brought to light this subject and discussion. I was asked to testify to Congress, so I did that, and I was asked to testify on the subject of the misogyny in the military culture, which I thought was remarkably progressive of them, and this was since Obama was elected. So I testified about misogyny in the military culture and their relation between that and sexual assault. And there was a man from the Defense Department there who was second in command of the wonderful military acronym SAPRO, which stands for Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office, who told me he'd read my book and they were trying to follow all the suggestions in the last chapter, which proved to me that he knew there was a last chapter, but beyond that I wasn't sure I believed a word of it. it's largely a PR office, as far as in my opinion. But anyway, they are aware of it. I have got this book into the hands of several Congress people who've been very active on behalf of veterans' rights and especially women. So I'm hoping it'll have an effect. And they are revamping and really think they're doing more studies after doing just about nothing for 11 years. There's something going on that I hope will have some effect.
Maybe you can call your next book Beyond FUBAR. How about there in the back row?
Hi, Helen. It's April Fitzsimmons.
Oh, so nice to meet you. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, no worries. I just want to thank you for the book as a veteran and a survivor. I wanted to speak to some of the things that came up that I felt like people in the room maybe could use being local. One of the things I think that's really helpful right now, and it's bold, but I feel like until SAPRO and until Washington takes a more serious look at what's happening, more extreme measures need to be taken. And one of those is if you meet women in the military or you know of a local recruiting station, you can simply hang out or go to your high schools and let women know that, in my opinion, the military is a dangerous place for women right now. And until the government does something much more proactive and radical to stop this, then I don't think women should be joining, because it's not enough. The survivors that I speak to and the organizations, it's just not enough to continue to let them go in and be potentially one of the three. So that's my personal opinion. And also something that's not really discussed is tracking the perpetrators. So in my case, my perpetrator was found out and shipped off a base, but I don't know where he is today, and maybe he got help and so on and so forth, but maybe he didn't, and maybe he became a civilian and is in our community. So there's really no way right now to track the perpetrators, and I think that's something that we could demand of Washington. And so I feel like ways that the community can take a more active role are simply visiting the VA and signing up for the volunteer program. There are women that are filtering through our Los Angeles VA that are survivors and need help. And the other thing is if you're working in the social sciences or in psychology, it would be really great to be able to offer free counseling and take out some sort of public awareness campaign to just let women know that there are other places besides the VA if they're not comfortable with that, because it does affect their record. And the last thing was a question for you. I didn't know that about the combat being banned, but my question, especially for, I think the woman who's here was a combat vet, is that if the combat is banned in the doctrine, then it could mean that women down the road will not get the benefits that other combat veterans will get. And so that is a real danger.
Yes, I'd like to speak to that, if I may, because that's a very important point. All your points are wonderful, and thank you very much for saying them. I've heard many cases of women going to the VA to get help with traumatic brain injury, physical injuries, as well as psychological, that they got because of being in mortar attacks or explosions and bombs and so on, being shot at. And they've been told, you couldn't have got that in combat because you're banned from combat, so you it must be a pre-existing condition, so you're lying, go away. I mean, the injustice of that, doesn't it make you want to just shoot out the ceiling? So I see nods. I think people have experienced this. Yes. So it's, and also some of the training. I mean, if you're going to have women in war, you have to recognize it and give them all the full training that, you know, that the infantry are getting. And you have to give them the recognition and the honors they've earned, as well as the help. And so it's a mess all around. Congress does at least recognize that there's this ridiculous paradox going on, and they have been planning hearings on it. Maybe they've even had a couple. But yes, good point.
Down here in the purple sweater.
I'm Dr. Judith Broder, and I run the Soldiers Project.
Oh, great.
And so April, so we are a group of mental health specialists who offer free counseling to anyone who served in Iraq or Afghanistan, and is completely confidential. We see people in our private offices, we have special training, and we have women who come who tell these same stories over and over and over again. But there is help outside of the VA, and we're easy to contact. There's no waiting, and it's really free.
So, where are you based?
Well, now we're in a lot of cities, but we have about 300 therapists in the Southern California area. So I have some cards if anyone's interested.
That's terrific. Thanks. Yeah, I think, don't you have a branch in Connecticut too? Because I've.
Didn't you have a question? Wait, before you leave with the microphone, there was someone in the same row.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you about. From my own experience, I come from another country, and my experience as a young person and the youth of my country is that we don't trust the military very much, and also we always question ourselves about the government. And what I have seen here in this country is that the young people, they trust a lot the military, and also they don't question themselves, and they volunteer to get into the military. And I was wondering, why is that? I mean, you know? Yeah, because usually, I mean, in other countries, I know that where I come from, I mean, with the military, someone, the military come to you and you just go like, hey, you know, you question yourself all, you know, what's going on, they want.
That's an interesting question, because it brings up something I like to address, which is that there's a huge gap between the military and civilian cultures here. We haven't experienced soldiers storming into our homes and killing our brothers and our sisters and fathers and so on, as in so many countries. We haven't had the military dominate us on our home turf in the same way or abuse us. But the military keeps itself very much within a kind of bubble, which is built around the myth of it being, you know, a wonderful, noble, patriotic institution, and there's an enormous amount of sentimentality around it. And then one of the reasons the military is so protective of itself, makes all the soldiers sign a gag rule before they join, so it's promising not to talk about, to criticize the mission or the president or anything to do with their work to the press. They sign away their freedom of speech. They sign away all their civil rights, for that matter. But that helps keep the population ignorant of what really goes on. So it's there, you know, and then they watch TV and they see the ads, and and they get all this propaganda on Fox News and so on about how great the military is and how noble it is and how you will go to the to a place like Iraq and offer freedom and liberation. And people do believe it because they're not getting any other message. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I'm hoping to cross that gap a little bit between civilians and the military, not only for those reasons I just said, but also because it makes it harder for the soldiers themselves to feel understood by anybody when they come home. Because of that, that gap is so huge. They don't, not enough civilians understand what they really go through in at war, and what it's like to be in the military. It's so different from civilian life. Michaela said to me and many others that I don't talk about it to my family because I know they won't understand. And so the silence around it grows.
So I just wanted to add one comment about why people join the military here. I think I agree with some of what you're saying. It's a little more complicated than that, in my opinion. I mean, there are a lot of people in the military from the South, for instance, which has a very heavy tradition of service to country, that if they are called, they're the first to raise their hand. That's just it. That's what they do, for better or for worse. And also, you may not agree with this, and other people in the room may not, but this country is under a threat, and it's legitimate, and it's been covered and proven on, you know, across the board. There has been written about by progressives and on the right. People are responding to that. So I think that has to be factored in also to this question of why people join up. It's very, very complicated.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of also economic reasons. Pay for college, have adventures, and I don't think there's a big difference between why men and women join either. There's a whole list of reasons. But yeah, I talk about it in the book. I agree.
Right.
Yeah, and there is the family tradition. And there's the sense that it is a noble, patriotic, it's the right thing to do, because the military are there to protect us. That's still very much believed.
Okay. Are you raising your hand? Or you're pointing?
I think he's raising his hand.
Okay, sure.
I think it's a myth that these wars are patriotic. The wars are fought to make the military-industrial complex more profit. The more wars there are, corporations that make all these barbaric weapons, modern technology, they sell more. They sell them to foreign countries. That's why on television, you see, if they ever cover foreign countries, they're always militarism. So it's big business, and it isn't patriotic, usually.
One more question?
Is somebody in the front here?
There's somebody right down here. Okay, so there were a few people raising their hands, sorry.
I'd really like to thank you for coming here, because what you've described is an absolute nightmare scenario, which I can't even begin to get my brain around. But if it's okay with them, I would really like the women soldiers here tonight to stand up so we can honor them.
Yes.
Well, that's a nice thing.
Yes.
So you won't be lonely soldiers tonight, at least. Band of sisters. What? Oh.
Okay. We let.
Hi. I'm Staff Sergeant Alicia Watkins. I'm retired from the Air Force. Purple Heart, September 11th. Traumatic brain injury recipient, both in the Iraq and the Afghanistan war. Michaela is funny that we crossed paths. She's my roommate. I love her to death. So it's just so funny how we have become friends. I said all that to say that I was also a multiple rape victim. Everything that could be done was done. But on the other side of, you know, the Lady Singh being military is just a very violent place, I had a different experience. Every time that I got assaulted or got harassed, they were on me like I would not believe. The help that I got from the command, whatever branch I was in, was tremendous. It has given me the power to continue to speak on these issues. I can say I'm glad that the book is written for the women who have not experienced this, but my experience has been awesome to the point where I've dedicated my life to bringing awareness not only to the fact that it does happen, but if it does happen, so many people took me. As far as the traumatic brain injury, I got so many appointments, and they're just, the VA is just on me so hard. So I just wanted to let you know that I just wanted to let some of the other women know, but there is help out there, and there are success stories in the midst of all the gunk and all the stuff that's going on. There's some of us that have become functional individuals, and I'm so honored to be roommating with Michaela, that this is like a movie that we don't even know about. But I just wanted to thank you for bringing her story to light. So
thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.